From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new remake of Ocean's 11 is built around the star power of George Clooney, Julia Roberts, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, and Don Cheadle. Our film critic John Powers will have a review, but first we'll talk about the stars of the 1960 film Ocean's 11, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., and the other members of the Rat Pack. We'll hear from the author of Rat Pack Confidential. We'll talk with Mia Farrow about what it was like to be married to the leader of the pack. And we'll examine the FBI's files on Sinatra with the editors of a book collecting them. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The nation's unemployment rate rose to a six-year high last month. The Labor Department says the jobless rate jumped to 5.7%. President Bush used the report to urge Democrats in Congress to drop their objections to the administration's economic stimulus program proposed in October. But Democrats say the spike in the jobless level underscores their position that the White House package is long on tax cuts for the wealthy and short on help for the unemployed. The Taliban is no longer in control of the Afghan city of Kandahar. The BBC's Susanna Price reports from Quetta, Pakistan.
The Taliban fighters have now pulled out of their last stronghold, Kandahar, but the city is far from peaceful. Local residents reported scenes of chaos in the streets and said shops have been looted. A spokesman for an anti-Taliban force, led by a former governor of the city, said they had clashed with other opposition fighters because they wanted a greater share of power. While Kandahar's new administration tries to restore order, attention is turning to the fate of the Taliban leadership. The newly appointed leader of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, who brokered the surrender of the city, says he doesn't know where the Taliban spiritual leader, Mullah Omar, is, but that they hadn't allowed him to escape.
The BBC's Susanna Price. President Bush today told servicemen and women at the Naval Air Base in Norfolk, Virginia, that the United States will fight the terrorists in Afghanistan until their network is torn apart piece by piece. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The president went to Norfolk to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. He told thousands of sailors assigned to the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise that the country faces a similar threat again. He likened today's terrorists to fascists of the past. He said they had the same global ambitions and must be dealt with in the same way.
Like all fascists, the terrorists cannot be appeased. They must be defeated. This struggle will not end in a truce or a treaty. It will end in victory for the United States, our friends, and for the cause of freedom.
The president told the crowd that the Taliban now control little more than a few caves in Afghanistan, but he also said the fight was far from over. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
Israeli helicopter gunships attacked a Palestinian military compound in southern Gaza today. Witnesses reportedly say at least 8 missiles were fired. The attack was aimed at a compound in Rafah containing offices of the Palestinian military and general intelligence services, as well as Palestinian President Yasser Arafat's elite bodyguard. No immediate word on casualties. Space Shuttle Endeavour has docked with the International Space Station. On board the shuttle is a 3-member crew to relieve the men who've been on the station since August. Stock prices were generally lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 49 points to 1049. The Nasdaq was down 33 points. You're listening to NPR News. In Florida, state prosecutors have dropped 220 counts of murder against a jet maintenance company that was implicated in the 1996 crash of a Value Jet airliner. NPR's Philip Davis has more on that story.
Sabretech was the first U.S. aviation company ever to face murder charges in connection with an airline crash. 220 counts in all, or 2 for each of the 110 passengers who died in the crash. State prosecutors had contended the company improperly labeled a shipment of flammable chemical oxygen generators. Investigators say the generators either started or intensified a fire in the hold of ValueJet Flight 592, which crashed soon after taking off on May 11, 1996. Sabretech is now basically defunct, and local state's attorney Catherine Fernandez-Rundle says Florida has now agreed to a plea bargain. In exchange for the state dropping murder charges, the company would plead guilty to a hazardous materials count and make a $500,000 donation to two air disaster relief funds. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
Federal authorities are looking for possible biological agents, toxins, and bomb-making materials in a car used by Clayton Lee Wagner. He's the fugitive caught this week in Ohio, who's accused of sending hundreds of anthrax hoax letters to abortion clinics nationwide. Court papers show the agents are also looking for cash, firearms, computers, and software, among other things. More than 200 New Jersey teachers were released from jail today. They're free now that they and their striking colleagues have agreed to return to work on Monday. Judges had been sending the teachers to jail this week for ignoring a back-to-work order. By this morning, there were 228 teachers in jail. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Merrill Lynch, offering customized wealth management services for qualified investors. 1-800-MERRILL or www.askmerrill.ml.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new remake of Ocean's 11 opened today. We'll have a review of it a little later, but first we talk about the stars of the original Ocean's 11, the Rat Pack.
This is our objective, Las Vegas, Nevada. Mission, to liberate millions of dollars.
These are the five casinos we hit. Sahara, Riviera, Desert Inn, the Sands, and the Flamingo. 8 hours, New Year's Eve. The units involved, special combat teams made up of former members of the 82nd Airborne.
Just for curiosity, how did you figure this is a job for old paratroopers? Why didn't you just get some regular heist guys?
For the best of reasons, Mr. Harmon. A man with a criminal record can't get near Las Vegas, much less the casinos.
Well, I guess that lets me out.
Don't be ridiculous. You know Hoodlum. You got no connection with the underworld.
Hoods are always mixed up with other hoods. Where there are hoods, there are stool pigeons. But with us, no stoolies, no leaks.
Now, you five guys working in the hotels, which hotels are you in?
Flamingo. The Sands.
Desert Inn. Riviera.
A scene from the 1960 film Ocean's 11. Sean Levy is the author of the book Rat Pack Confidential, which covers the years 1958 to 63. It's the story of how Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, Peter Lawford, and Joey Bishop became known as the Rat Pack, got connected with the mob and the Kennedy campaign, and epitomized some of the best and worst of show business. On and off stage, their behavior ranged from very entertaining to incredibly crude. Here's Sammy with Frank and Dino from a new CD featuring them live at the Sands in 1963.
This song has always held a very special spot in my heart because it's the first song I ever recorded. Hey there.
Yes?
I've never made a move.
You want to laugh, Sam? Go out and sit in the audience.
Hey there.
What the hell you want, Sam? Baby.
From to you. You think someday she will come to you.
Better forget her.
Good, Sam. What else do you want to say?
I spoke with Sean Levy about his book Rat Pack Confidential in 1998. I asked him how the Rat Pack got its name.
There was a Rat Pack prior to the Sinatra Rat Pack. Humphrey Bogart and his cronies, including Sinatra, had been in Las Vegas for a kind of debauched weekend. They actually went to see Noel Coward at the Desert Inn. And Sinatra and Bogart and these folk were all there, David Niven, I believe, Judy Garland. And Lauren Bacall walked in on them after they'd been partying for a few days and said, "Geez, you all look like a Rat Pack." And a few nights later, she said it to them again, and this time they went through the motions of forming a society with this name, and they had, you know, official titles. They even had stationery. After Bogart's death, Sinatra sort of drew on that energy and put together his own coterie of friends. Some of Bogart's circle were in it, but mostly it was Sinatra's buddies. And the Rat Pack name sort of got dragged along. Frank always hated it, But the alternative was the Klan. And the Klan didn't sound too good when civil rights had started. So the Rat Pack they became. Years later, Frank dismissed it as that stupid phrase, but he could never shake it.
Let me run through some of the people who were in the Rat Pack and get you to briefly describe what their place in that group was, starting with Sinatra.
Sinatra was the padrone, the Pope. They all worked for him. You know, he produced the movies that they made. He owned the record company. He owned the casino, or at least parts of the casino. And he was also the person who set the style. He chose the people. He showed them how to dress, how to order food at a restaurant. He was really the sort of the center of the universe for this group.
Dean Martin.
Dean was like Frank's blood brother. He was the only guy who could consistently tell Frank no when Frank wanted to party at 2 a.m. or when Frank wanted to go into some business deal. And, Dean was a perfect foil for Frank on stage. He'd been Jerry Lewis's straight man, and then Frank became his. Dean was exquisitely funny.
Sammy Davis.
Sammy's the kid brother. You know, Frank always, in the best sense of the word, patronized minority artists. He always had black groups on the act with him. He always had black musicians in his band. And he knew Sammy from when Sammy was a teenager performing with his dad and uncle. So he became the little brother, and he, more than anyone, I think, slavishly imitated Frank's way of life, way of speech, way of dressing.
Peter Lawford.
Poor Peter. Peter was a bridge, you know, between Frank Sinatra and his circle and Jack Kennedy and his circle. Frank explicitly and deliberately made an alliance with Peter to get to the Kennedy campaign, and then when the Kennedys sort of washed their hands of Frank, Frank dumped Peter. So it was a pretty painful relationship for Lawford, I think, on both sides of the equation, because the Kennedys didn't really respect him as a man's man either.
Peter Lawford was married to one of John Kennedy's sisters.
That's right. And it was kind of an embarrassment because he was a man whose movie career had sort of washed out, his TV career had washed out. And then he became known in the Sinatra household, anyhow, as the brother in Lawford. So it was not a position that, you know, demanding a lot of respect, you know, in and of itself.
Okay, and Joey Bishop, the comic.
Well, Joey was the comic, and he was sort of the MC when the Rat Pack performed together in Vegas and Miami. And he was a traffic cop on stage who kept the act going. And I think also he was kind of a beard who, you know, during those years, anyhow, before the sort of darker sides of the whole era became known widely, I think Joey was sort of a way to say, hey, it's showbiz. Joey Bishop is here. What else could it be? This isn't a real life scene. This is an act.
What were some of the most famous shticks within the Rat Pack's stage act?
Oh, gosh. They would perform sort of a pastiche of a nightclub act. One of the three singers would come out and start to sing and be interrupted. Sometimes, you know, really coarsely. You know, it was Vegas. It was, you know, adult entertainment. And things that they said would be sort of outrageous to us now, say, in terms of race or ethnic identity or gender. Sammy, for instance, would get lifted up into the air by Dean or Frank, and they'd go to the mic and say, I'd like to thank the NAACP for this award. You know, we can't imagine laughing at that now, and it would just bring down the house. But they would bring a bar cart out and mix drinks. Dean would always say, you know, I'll make me another salad or something like this. Someone would start to sing a song, and the three or four others would just trample all over it. They worked always toward the same finale. When it was the entire Rat Pack, they sang The Birth of the Blues with special lyrics. And you even see Johnny Carson sing it with them in the 1965 Dismas House special. So it was a routine. It was about an hour and a half show that they could run to 2.5 hours if they were feeling spirited, you know, at the end of the night. Pretty corny old burlesque stuff, though. Nothing as penetrating as Lenny Bruce or Mort Saul.
You know, they made a lot of homophobic jokes and jokes about Jews and blacks and Italians. So they were putting down each other and then also putting down people who were not represented on stage. I think that stuff doesn't play back very well right
no,
now.
No, it doesn't. And surely that's the sort of thing that people objected to, you know, as the 60s went on and people became more aware of the ways in which humor and language could be hurtful. I think that that helped the Rat Pack fall from favor, that they were still, you know, Frank would tell Sammy to hurry up and finish the song "The Watermelon Was Getting Warm," you know, things like that. I mean, that just makes me cringe to, you know, to see. And there's Sammy, you know, slapping his knee the way he does with the open mouth laugh. It's kind of a grisly sight in retrospect.
But it seemed to not bother them at the time.
Well, it didn't bother Frank and Dean at any rate. Sammy, in his autobiography, wrote about knowing that there was a double edge to the humor, but also knowing how Frank had always stood behind him and thinking, well, this is shtick. This is what we do. It's part of an act. His wife at the time, a Swedish actress by the name of Mai Britt, was very upset with Sammy's treatment at the hands of Frank and Dean, even though he always said to her, honey, it's in jest. They're stand-up guys. They don't mean it. She felt it was very demeaning, and she really couldn't make him see that.
The Rat Pack's artistic home was Vegas. What was the role of the Rat Pack in attracting people to Vegas and to in creating the identity of Vegas?
If you speak to old-timers in Vegas, they all credit the Rat Pack with kind of saving the town. In the mid-50s, after the first boom on the Strip, Vegas became built up very quickly. But the tourism wasn't matching the construction. People were still going to Havana to gamble and party. Miami was still a huge entertainment capital as well as a vacation capital. And as Sinatra became more and more associated with Las Vegas, he bought into the Sands Hotel. Dean Martin owned a share of the hotel. He played there more and more. I don't think it's a coincidence that the Rat Pack Summit, the appearance of the five big stars on the stage at the Sands, is roughly around the time that the hotels were nationalized in Havana. You know, Castro took the casinos away from their stateside owners, fellas like Meyer Lansky. And suddenly, there was this big tourist attraction in Las Vegas, the Rat Pack. And the town that had been sort of teetering, was overbuilt and had too many rooms and not enough guests, suddenly seemed a lot more stable. Within a few years, there were more hotels, there was a convention center, and the Rat Pack really are credited by the people in Las Vegas with sort of helping define that change, helping turn things for the city.
Was it just what they did on stage that attracted people to Vegas, or was it their partying and stuff off stage that also helped make the Vegas reputation?
I think it was a little of both. I think, you know, one of the allures of the act was that you didn't really think all the time that you were seeing an act, that it seemed like, hey, this is what they're really like. You know, Vegas was so small then. You know, we think of these monolithic hotels they have there today. The Sands had 200 rooms in 1960, and that was the most luxurious hotel on the Strip. So it was a very tiny place, and these guys would walk around the casino after they performed or on their way to performing. You know, there were no sort of security alleys for them to duck through the way there are in the large hotels today. And I think the idea you could go to Las Vegas and maybe Sammy would show up at the Riviera and get on stage with the lounge act drew a lot of people to the city.
My guest is Sean Levy, author of Rat Pack Confidential. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sean Levy, author of Rat Pack Confidential. What do you consider to be the end of the Rat Pack?
Well, there's the way I wrote about it is to take a period of time when they were working on a film together. Robin and the Seven Hoods was in production on November 22nd, 1963, when John Kennedy was killed. When that film came out the following August, the Beatles, who had never been in the United States prior to the beginning of the filming, had five top 10 hits. And there's the sea change right there. In about an 8 or 9 month span, the whole mystique of, you know, adults and a kind of licentious sort of ribbing lifestyle had been replaced by a very innocent seeming teenage idealism that, you know, Frank, Dean, Sammy, Peter, they couldn't compete with.
Of course, Sinatra still went on to have hits and to make some really good recordings.
Oh, they all did. They, you know, Dean had his NBC TV series. Sammy was still years away from Candyman and, you know, his biggest hits. But they were playing to a smaller crowd. You know, I've written that they lost the main room and were playing in the lounge. The kids definitely took over the center stage, and they really have ever since. You know, the no adult entertainers have consistently outsold youth acts in the music business ever since the arrival of the Beatles. And sort of, you know, in terms of who controls the cultural, you know, conversation, I think we still look to youth culture to this day.
How did writing your book affect your opinion of the Rat Pack? Did it change your mind about anybody?
Well, I particularly felt more and more empathy with Sammy Davis Jr. You know, in our time, he's, you know, something of a joke, and he ended badly. You know, he was hounded by the IRS. He was, you know, he suffered, you know, terrible ill health during the last year or so of his life, and he became kind of shorthand for showbiz insincerity and glitz and sleaze and you know, a lot of bad comedians, you know, made hay out of imitating him.
A lot of good ones too.
But when you look at his story, you know, I always thought of him as the Jackie Robinson of showbiz, and you look at what he had to endure. You know, Las Vegas was not an integrated town during most of this Rat Pack period. And Sammy, as a result, was the first black entertainer to be allowed to stay on the Strip, the first black entertainer to be allowed to gamble in the hotels, and on like this. And, you know, we tend to think of him as this kind of little, you know, guy capering around there with Frank and Dean. But when he got off that stage, he was subject to a completely different kind of treatment from the rest of them. And I grew to admire his ability to sort of plow through that and, you know, sort of stay true to his intention of being, you know, a great entertainer and a great sort of example to people who he hoped could follow him.
Sean Levy is the author of Rat Pack Confidential. I spoke with him in 1998 when the book was published. Today we're talking about the Rat Pack, the stars of the original Ocean's 11, which was made in 1960. Mia Farrow was married to the leader of the pack, Frank Sinatra, from 1966 to 68. She grew up in a Hollywood family with father, director John Farrow, and mother, actress Maureen O'Sullivan. I spoke with Mia Farrow in 1997 after the publication of her memoir. Your first husband was Frank Sinatra, and you first met him when you were 11 and you were dining out with your father. Do you think he remembered meeting you?
Oh, probably not. I don't know. I never asked him. And I was too embarrassed to bring it up because it was when, I was a kid. I guess I was about 11, so, but that was not too far, too many years before. You know, I met him when I was 19, so 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 8 years earlier. I didn't want to remind him that, you know, that I was that young, so I didn't bring it up.
As you mentioned earlier, a lot of people in the public were just astonished that the 50-year-old Frank Sinatra would be seeing and then marrying the, 20 or 20-something-year-old Mia Farrow. What was that age discrepancy like for you, that approximately 30-year difference?
Well, it really meant that we didn't have a shared history, that he had a history that I knew nothing about.
You didn't even know his records or his movies.
No, I didn't know those things, nor had I lived through, you know, the things that he had lived through. I mean, even culturally or, you know, in any way, historically, I didn't have the knowledge that he had in any way, his friendships, all those things. So, you know, you're left out of a great deal, and I think that plays itself out in lots of different ways. You know, when he met with friends and stuff, you know, the things that they would talk about, I couldn't be a part of. So there is that always, and I guess that was the main thing, you know, that I just didn't know what he was talking about so much of the time.
Was it hard being young and still in a lot of ways unformed, unsure of yourself as a woman, and, you know, in a relationship with a man who's incredibly famous, very secure in his own identity? I mean, his identity is iconic by that point.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on the other thing, the just the feeling of inadequacy that would just swamp me all the time, because I was unformed and I didn't know what I wanted from life. I had no idea who I was. I wasn't even sure what I believed, you know, what my opinions were about things. And, you know, I was still very much learning, you know, so the way I viewed myself and my future, all of it. You know, I was so unsure of everything.
It always strikes me that in a relationship like that, the young woman is always at risk of having more of a mentor than a partner.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's hard to, it can't be, I think it's difficult for it to be in an equal partnership. It would have been impossible for me because I deferred to him in all aspects.
Did you find that your husband was different when he was with the Rat Pack than when he was alone with you?
Yes, totally. The Rat Pack was an outside name, you know. Nobody used those words
right.
When I didn't even know about them until later, and I'm not sure exactly what it referred to. But in Las Vegas and on those sorts of evenings, yes. Well, you know, all the guys, it was a very macho thing. You know, mm-hmm. The guys would drink a lot and smoke a lot and tell jokes a lot. And the women would be very, very quiet. And they, too, would smoke and sip a little wine, spritzers, and, you know, just softly, maybe after a couple of hours, ask each other a couple of questions. But the women wouldn't even know each other. They were, you know, usually dates. A couple of times wives, but it was very male-dominated.
Mia Farrow recorded in 1997. More on Sinatra and the new film Ocean's 11 in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You do something to me, something that simply mystifies me. Tell me, why should it be? You got the power to hypnotize me. Let me live neath your spell. Do-do, that voodoo that you do so well. Cause you do something to me.
Nobody. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Honorable Company, a novel of India before the Raj by Alan Mallison. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, John Powers reviews the new remake of Ocean's 11. The original version starred Frank Sinatra and his Rat Pack cronies. We'll hear about the files the FBI kept on Sinatra during the Rat Pack era.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I will show you around. I love it, bet you bottom dollar you lose the blues in Chicago, Chicago, the town that Billy Sunday couldn't shut down. On State Street, that great street, I just want to say, they do things they don't do on Broadway. They have the time of their life. I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago, Chicago, my hometown.
That's Frank Sinatra from the new CD, EO11, The Best of the Rat Pack. A little later, we'll have a review of the new remake of Ocean's 11. The original 1960 version starred Frank Sinatra as gambler Danny Ocean, who's planning a heist on five Vegas casinos. During the Rat Pack era, Sinatra was one of the most written about celebrities. But it wasn't just journalists who were chronicling his life, it was the FBI. The Bureau amassed a 1,275-page dossier on the singer and actor. That dossier is excerpted and analyzed in the book The Sinatra Files. The book recently came out in paperback. Last year, when it was first published, I spoke with the editors, Tom Koontz, who's an editor with the New York Times, and his brother, Phil Koontz, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. During the Rat Pack era, the FBI investigated Sinatra's connections to the mob.
One thing that the FBI files prove beyond any doubt is that Frank Sinatra hung out with mobsters. There's little doubt about that. They have firsthand accounts of, you know, of witnesses describing Sinatra hanging out with these people. They have, for a time, they were actually observing Sinatra hanging out with Sam Giancana. There are tape recordings of mobsters talking about their having had conversations with Sinatra. All of this, you know, proves beyond any doubt that he was hanging out with mobsters. What the FBI was suspicious of, and one could say somewhat legitimately, is that Sinatra was a popular singer of the time, and he was also entertaining and getting involved in business deals in Las Vegas and elsewhere. The FBI was concerned that the mob was going to infiltrate those business enterprises, and they were always on the lookout for people who were acting as fronts for the mob. Sinatra, being a close friend of some of these mobsters, was an obvious suspect. They never got anything, you know, definitive in that regard. Later, Sinatra was also befriended some prominent politicians, and that I don't think anybody can dispute that that made him worthy of attention if he was hanging out with mobsters and presidents and other prominent politicians at the same time.
A famous Rat Pack evening, it was the grand reopening of the club Villa Venice in suburban Chicago, a club either owned or financed by Sam Giancana, the head of the Chicago mob. And an informant tells the FBI, and this is in your book, that the Villa Venice is financially in trouble, and for this reason Sinatra and his associates are scheduled to entertain. They are not going to receive the amount of money they reportedly were scheduled to receive in return for their services. The implication being that they're doing that this is a benefit for their buddy Sam Giancana. In fact, Dean Martin kids about this in a medley of songs that he does. Why don't we hear his satirical lyric, See the Lady as a Tramp.
I love Chicago. It's carefree and gay. I'd even work here without any pay. I'll lay you off. It turns out that way. That's why this gentleman is a tramp. My clever agent, he worked out this deal. He said, go to Chicago, it won't be for real. And I believed him, I'm such a schlemiel. That's why the gentleman is a tramp.
That's Dean Martin from an evening of the Rat Pack at the club Villa Venice, which was financed by Sam Giancana. What was the nature of Sinatra's relationship with Giancana?
They were, in looking over the files, I struggled with that, and I think I've come to the conclusion that they both were kind of, on some level, sycophantic. The mobster liked to hang out with Sinatra because he was famous, and Sinatra liked to hang out with mobsters because he was a bad boy. Now, Giancana had a vested interest in courting Sinatra in the 1959-1960 era because he wanted to somehow gain influence to get the FBI to back off its crackdown on the mob. At this point, the FBI was really getting serious. Hoover, for years, had denied the existence of the mob. He had recently been proved wrong that there was organized crime in the United States, and as a result, started a huge crackdown on them. Sinatra offered a way for them to get friendly with, or at least have entree to, President Kennedy when he started running for president. And there's people quoted in the documents saying that Sinatra was working for the campaign for Jack Kennedy in order to get the mob to have an entree.
Now, Sinatra was also close to John F. Kennedy during the period that Kennedy was running for the presidency. What are the connections that are documented that Sinatra made between the mob and Kennedy?
Well, from early on, Sinatra was introduced to Kennedy by Peter Lawford, who was a Kennedy in-law. And from early on, the FBI, which was watching presidential candidates, from early on, the FBI knew about Kennedy's relationship with Sinatra, because Kennedy at this point was clearly a presidential aspirant. This is in the late 1950s. So you have the FBI kind of watching almost in real time as their relationship unfolds. And what a relationship it was. I mean, they had a mutual Sinatra-like power, whether it was legitimate or illegitimate. And Kennedy and Sinatra both like sex, if you believe the FBI files. And the files chronicle their wild partying. One memo refers to, quotes a gangster as saying something about all those broads Sinatra brought JFK, showgirls running in and out of the senator's suite in Las Vegas, where he and Sinatra were partying. So early on, and through the Kennedy administration, the FBI was watching Sinatra very closely.
One of the evidence of that is that Sinatra who introduced a former girlfriend of his, Judith Campbell, to President Kennedy, who we now know became his mistress when he was in the White House. And he introduced her to him in January of 1960. Kennedy came to Las Vegas, I think to do some fundraising, but ended up hanging out with Sinatra and the rest of the Rat Pack. They were there filming Ocean's 11, their first big movie. And they were also doing shows at the Sands. Frank Sinatra introduced Judith Campbell to John Kennedy during that visit. And 3 weeks later, a memo appears on Hoover's desk saying that part of it said that Kennedy had been compromised with a woman there. It didn't name who she was, but it's pretty clear that that's who they're referring to. So we didn't find out, meaning the American public didn't find out about Judith Campbell until 1975 or so. J. Edgar Hoover at least had a good hint of what was going on 3 weeks after it happened.
Did Sinatra also introduce Judith Campbell to Sam Giancana? His mistress as well.
She became his mistress at some point. It's not quite clear that there was overlap there. There's some dispute about that. And that is actually how the FBI came to find out for sure about Judith Campbell, because Judith Campbell was associating with Sam Giancana, so the FBI started watching her. Then they noticed that she was making, by looking at her phone records, noticed that not only was she talking to Sam Giancana, one of his underlings named Johnny Roselli, and Frank Sinatra, at the same time that she was on a fairly regular basis calling the White House, President Kennedy's secretary. As a result of those phone calls, J. Edgar Hoover wrote a memo to
the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, the president's brother, informing him, hey, I just wanted to let you know that this woman who's, you know, apparently calling your brother is also hanging out with mobsters. That letter started a chain of events that caused Robert Kennedy to finally confront his brother about basically his relationship with both Sinatra and Judith Campbell. And as a result of that, President Kennedy backed off Sinatra at one point in March of 1962. Sinatra was supposed to host Kennedy at his home in Palm Springs, and the administration decided that instead the president would go to Bing Crosby's house. That sent Sinatra into a rage. And he later eventually, not much later, but later eventually broke off his relationship with Judith Campbell. It's one of the more interesting things about what this book says about J. Edgar Hoover, because a lot of people look at the memos that J. Edgar Hoover would write and look at it and see in it some sort of an evil signal that Hoover was trying to tell Robert Kennedy and President Kennedy, look how much dirt I have on you. If you guys fire me, I'm going to bury you. When in fact, looked at another way, one could say that Hoover did us all a favor because the mob was fairly close to getting some influence in the White House. And Hoover, very quickly, very privately, without letting anybody else know, put a stop to it.
So, but was it Sinatra who introduced Judith Campbell to Sam Giancana?
Yes, mm-hmm. It was. Mm-hmm. He introduced Kennedy, I believe, first, and later she was introduced to him.
So did the FBI ever find any hard evidence that Sinatra was involved in any illegal mob-related activities, any activities beyond palling around with members of the mob?
They never got the goods on Sinatra. Sinatra was guilty of association, but guilt by association is not a crime. In fact, it's freedom of association is enshrined in the Constitution.
My guests are Tom and Phil Kuntz, editors of the Sinatra Files. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Tom and Phil Kuntz, editors of the Sinatra Files, about the FBI's dossier on Sinatra. I thought it was interesting that in April of 1963, the special agents in charge of the Los Angeles FBI office asked Hoover to consider bugging Sinatra's home in Palm Springs, and Hoover denied the request.
Exactly. It was another example, kind of surprising example, of Hoover's restraint, if you can imagine that with Hoover. For some reason, at this time, he decided that a microphone surveillance of Sinatra's Palm Springs home was legally unjustified. They didn't have probable cause, I suppose. But imagine if he had approved the bug, what that bug might reveal about Kennedy, Sinatra, and the mob.
Because some of the more interesting things in the book are tape recordings. Hoover was not above, as you can imagine, bugging somebody's house, and he had bugs all over the place in Chicago where Sam Giancana was known to hang out with his associates. And in those recordings, after the mob helped get Kennedy elected, Sam Giancana used his political muscle in Chicago and in West Virginia with the unions to help get out the vote for Kennedy in some pretty crucial ways. That's fairly well documented. After the election, the mob expected Frank Sinatra to get the Kennedys to go easy on them. Instead, President Kennedy appointed his brother, who was an anti-mob crusader from way back, as Attorney General, and the crackdown only intensified. That enraged the mob, and Sam Giancana and his associates can be heard on tape just fuming that Sinatra hadn't made good on his promise to get the FBI to back off. At one point, Johnny Roselli, an underling of Giancana's, quotes Sinatra in a conversation with Giancana, quotes Sinatra as saying, I took your name, Sam Giancana's name, and I wrote it down on a piece of paper, and I gave it to Bobby Kennedy, and I said, Bobby, I want you to know this man is my friend. I want you to know that, Bob. If that's true, it's a rather extraordinary thing to have a popular singer going to the Attorney General of the United States and asking him to lay off a mobster. Now, it's not quite clear that Sinatra actually did that because some of the mob in the Giancana and his friends voiced doubt about whether or not Sinatra was doing actually what he said he was doing, because at one point Sinatra, according to Giancana, also promised to talk to Joseph Kennedy, the president's father, and if that didn't work, to go to the president himself. And then Giancana starts acting, gets very, very angry when he says, who knows what this guy is doing, I don't know whether to believe him or not. Later, these underworld figures are quoted as actually either fantasizing or thinking out loud. It's not quite clear what they're doing about assassinating Sinatra, maybe his friend Dean Martin. Maybe at one point they talk about poking Sammy Davis Jr.'s other eye out. And one mobster actually fantasizes about throwing a bomb in the face of Bobby Kennedy and says he'd gladly go to jail for the rest of his life if he had a chance to do that. This stuff is kind of... It's troubling in retrospect, and it also, although neither Tommy nor I are conspiracy theorists about the assassination of President Kennedy, it certainly does give one pause when thinking about long-standing allegations that have never been proven that the mob may have been involved.
Frank Sinatra actually got his FBI files through the Freedom of Information Act in 1981. Do you know what impact it had on him to read them and what he did with the information?
I don't know if he was. I think what he said publicly about the files was that it didn't prove anything illegal on his part, mob-wise or otherwise. I don't think he elaborated very much about what was in the files. He got the files released to him so that he could show them to Nevada gaming officials so that he could get his casino license restored. Neither the gaming officials nor Sinatra made the files public at that time. And Sinatra got his gaming license back, which suggested at the time that there was nothing untoward in the files. However, Sinatra also exerted great political influence to get his gaming license back. He had a letter of recommendation from President Reagan to also help him get his license back. So it didn't answer questions about Sinatra. It only raised further ones, I think.
He had gone from being an alleged communist sympathizer to being a Republican, he sang at President Reagan's inaugural.
All right. He also entertained at the Nixon White House. You can see, however, that during Hoover's lifetime and even a little bit after Hoover's lifetime, every politician who cozied up to Frank Sinatra was given a detailed memo from the FBI saying, here's, you know, just thought you'd be interested in the background of this person that you're cozying up to. The Nixon White House got these detailed memos, laying out all of the times that Frank Sinatra is known to have associated with mobsters. And 2 months later, the White House is actively considering whether or not to take advantage of Sinatra's started leaning rightward and whether or not they should take advantage of that. And eventually they did. Spiro Agnew started playing golf with them regularly. He also played golf with President Nixon, and he was invited to state dinners. And the peak of that relationship came when Sinatra came out of retirement. He had announced his retirement in the early 70s, and at the request of Richard Nixon, he came out of retirement to entertain the visiting Italian president at the White House at a state dinner.
It's testimony to his iconic status that presidents, even despite, you know, the downside of his associations with mobsters and what have you, saw a political benefit in, currying favor with this man of great talents and a great hold on the popular imagination.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ter.
Tom and Phil Koontz are the editors of the Sinatra Files. We spoke last year when it was first published. It's now out in paperback.
Be wise, be smart, behave, my heart. Don't upset your card when she's so close. Be soft, be sweet, but be discreet. Don't go off your beat. She's so close,
for comfort. Too close for comfort. Please, not again. Too close to know just when to say when. Be firm, be fair, be sure, beware. On your guard, take care. While there's such temptation, one thing leads to another. Too late to run for cover. She's much too close for comfort now.
Coming up, John Powers reviews the new remake of the Rat Pack movie Ocean's 11. This is Fresh Air. The 1960 film Ocean's 11 was the first film that starred the Rat Pack. The new remake has plenty of star power, with a cast that includes George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, Julia Roberts, and Don Cheadle. It was directed by Steven Soderbergh, who also made Erin Brockovich and Traffic. Our film critic John Powers has a review of Ocean's 11.
When the original Ocean's 11 first came out, I was too young to see it, but I always thought it sounded great. Who wouldn't want to see a Vegas heist picture starring Frank and Dino and Sammy? But when I finally caught up with it years later, I was shocked. Almost insolently slack, the movie felt like a time capsule of pathetic swinger fantasies from the early 1960s. It was all boozy camaraderie and cheap racism. Sammy Davis Jr. was actually forced to drive a garbage truck. And it celebrated a manly style in which you said goodbye to a woman by giving her a nice slap on the rump. Things have been thoroughly modernized in Steven Soderbergh's new version, one of the rare remakes that can justify its existence. This Ocean's 11 is all the things the original was not: crisp, well-acted, and light-hearted. George Clooney plays Danny Ocean, an ex-con who gets out of jail with a dream. He wants to knock off three big Vegas casinos. He enlists his old pal Dusty Ryan, that's Brad Pitt, who's off in L.A. teaching smug young Hollywood actors how to play poker. Once Dusty's on board, Danny starts putting together his all-star team, including a pickpocket played by Matt Damon, a con man played by Carl Reiner, an electronics whiz played by Don Cheadle, a croupier played by the suddenly ubiquitous Bernie Mac, not to mention a Chinese gymnast. They head off to Vegas, where things certainly get tricky. It turns out that Danny's beloved ex-wife Tess, that's Julia Roberts, is now the squeeze of Andy Garcia's character, a ruthless businessman who owns all three of the targeted casinos. Of course, no one has ever robbed even a single casino before. Here, Clooney explains to Pitt's character why they should risk doing the big job.
I need a reason. Don't say money. Why do this?
Why not do it? Because yesterday I walked out of the joint after losing 4 years of my life, because the house always wins. Play long enough, you never change the stakes, the house takes you. Unless, when that perfect hand comes along, you bet big, and then you take the house.
Been practicing that speech, hadn't you?
A little bit. Did I rush it? Felt like I rushed it.
No, it was good. I liked it.
Ocean's 11 is hardly an artistic breakthrough for director Steven Soderbergh. Still, coming off Erin Brockovich and Traffic, two socially conscious dramas, Soderbergh doubtless felt that it would be fun to make a movie as light and empty as a bubble. The amazing thing is he pulls it off. Shimmeringly frivolous, Ocean's 11 makes the importance of being earnest seem like Oedipus Rex. Soderbergh photographed the movie himself, and he gives Las Vegas an alluring glamour. There's nothing cheesy about these casinos. and he knows how to let all his performers register, winning sharp comic performances from old pros like Reiner and from Elliot Gould, who plays a bad-taste casino owner with chest hair springing from his gaudy shirt like steel wool come to life. Soderbergh also gets the most from the pairing of Clooney and Pitt, the yin and yang of today's male stars, who have the easy rapport of real friends. As Danny, Clooney's a Hollywood lead of the old school, handsome, virile, with an easy way around a wisecrack. He's so in command of his scenes, he doesn't need to hog them. He plays perfectly off Pitt, the most beautiful of our actors, whose comic timing may be even better than Clooney's. These two give the movie its sex appeal, and compared to them, even co-stars like Matt Damon seem like, well, extras. If the original film is better in any way, it's that it had more cultural resonance. After all, the members of the Rat Pack weren't just real-life friends. They were players in Vegas, saloon singers and entertainers who hung out with criminals and exuded so much late-50s cool that even JFK dropped by as they were shooting. In some strange way, their movie was a training video for that particular idea of being hip. This new version carries no such charge. Just as today's Las Vegas aspires to be a playground for families, so stars like Clooney, Pitt, and Damon exude a wholesomeness that makes their robbing a casino seem like a boyish prank. The two movies offer very different visions of life. Without giving anything away, it's the difference between a movie steeped in boozy nightclub romanticism and one imbued with the values of a Beverly Hills health club. Ocean's 11 is assuredly not a great film, but it is a superb piece of escapism. It's like riding in a stretch limo filled with movie stars. Sure, a Ferrari might be faster and more exciting. A Rolls-Royce might be plusher and more elegant. But Soderbergh drives the star vehicle smoothly. The conversation is amusing. And you get to watch people who are cooler, luckier, and better looking than we could ever be.
John Powers is the executive editor of LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross.
It was just one of those things. Just one of those crazy flings. One of those bells that now and then rings. Just one of those things. It was just one of those nights. Just one of those fabulous flights. A trip to the moon on gossamer wings. Just one of those things. If we thought of it, about the end of it, when we started painting the town, we'd have been aware.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, unpleasant stories about three orphaned children whose lives are filled with woe as they are pursued by an evil count and forced to wear itchy clothing. We talk with Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, author of a best-selling series of humorous children's books. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.